Well, hello. I was told it was preacher's choice this morning. And in the tradition I come from, preacher's choice means you ask what's in the lectionary. So John 9 is the lectionary reading for today. And if you're familiar with the way lectionary works, the lectionary is a three-year cycle of reading. So every 3 years you get back to the same place, except for special things like Christmas. You read Christmas. But this story gets read every year on the fourth Sunday of Lent, along with last week everybody reads the Samaritan woman at the well, and next week everybody reads the raising of Lazarus, because it's considered that these stories have in them fundamental metaphors and imagery to do with the process of coming to faith in Christ. You've got images of life and death, water and light, and resurrection. And Easter is traditionally the time when people choose to be baptised, or in infant baptism traditions, confirmed. And Lent is the time of preparation for that. So these stories are part of the preparation for people for baptism. We as a community are actually baptising someone at Easter. David has asked to be baptised at Easter camp, so we are in the preparation for a baptism. And even if it's not your baptism, any baptism gives us all a chance to reconnect with the gift of our inclusion in God's family and our choice to take up God on that offer. So here we have the story of the blind man today in that context. It's a miracle tale expanded to have theological and symbolic meaning. And in the book of John, miracles are called signs, not miracles. They're not important in themselves, they're important for what they point to. It's significant that this man has been blind from birth. Sandra Schneider, who is the author who's probably most influenced what I'm saying today and her writing on this, writes that that makes the blind man a symbol of our universal congenital incapacity for divine life, which I really like. And what that means is the fact that we are all born unable to live God's shalom on our own, or even to see it. It also means that the man was born blind, hadn't become blind. Also means that Jesus creates sight rather than restoring sight, which is a slightly different thing going on then. And it's probably why the blind man then says, never since the start of the earth has anyone heard of someone restoring sight to someone who was born blind. That sense of creating sight sets Jesus up as different. Maybe somewhere people have managed to heal broken sight, but this is creation. Blind men were ritually unclean all the time because they couldn't see what they might be touching or just going near that might make them ritually impure. So he's not just blind, he's a social outcast because he's unclean, which in that system meant that other people couldn't come near him, or they became unclean and then they couldn't go to the synagogue, mostly, and a lot of other things. Making a paste to put on his eyes breaks the Sabbath, that's considered work. Healing breaks the Sabbath because that's considered work, except in an emergency, which gives you an insight into how the system of law had built up without compassion. I've never been in a situation where healing was an emergency that needed to be. When I was 9 months old, that's not true. I never remember being in a situation where I needed medical care as an emergency. But I can tell you I've been in lots of situations where I was in pain or sick or felt awful, where waiting one more day for medical care was just awful. And to be told, no, you can't do that, that's against the law, just reeks of lack of compassion. So Jesus heals, breaks the law, heals an unclean man. He sends him to the pool of Siloam. Siloam was a ritual pool for cleansing. It had ritually pure water in it. It was a series of a couple of pools. And they've actually recently archaeologically found it. They thought they'd found it, and then they're doing works in Jerusalem, and they found a much bigger one that they now realise is the actual pool of Siloam. And John translates it quite literally when he calls it, he says the sent one. He says Siloam means the sent one, which is a slight liberal use of the word of Siloam. But it's very important because John calls Jesus the Sent One. It's one of his favourite names for Jesus, is the Sent One. So he's saying to the man, go to the Sent One and plunge yourself in and you'll be clean. As a symbolic thing then, it's about plunging ourselves into Jesus. Not about washing something off of our outside, but soaking ourselves into something and soaking something into us. And this is a strong baptism image of what it means. It's not about just washing a bit of a crust off. It's about a transformation of something new just embedding through us when we soak into it. When I studied New Testament Greek, it was populated, all the grammar exercises were populated with blind men and tax collectors and sinners and maybe some Pharisees, because there's not a whole lot of nouns in the New Testament to work from, so we did a lot of work around blind men. And they become a caricature. You forget what that means. A bit like the Pharisees also become a caricature of bad people rather than human people facing a dilemma, which we'll get to in a bit. There's the stage where the crowd says to the blind man, where is this Jesus? And he says, I don't know. Well, duh, he doesn't know what Jesus looks like. Jesus could be standing right next to him, but he's only ever heard and smelt him. So he wasn't saying anything or he wasn't upwind. He wouldn't know who he was. Imagine never having seen. I'd like you all just now to close your eyes and experience this room without sight. That person next to you, all you know of them is their smell, sound, feeling, and maybe taste if you know them very well. And if that person is not someone you came with, you might actually have forgotten as you closed your eyes who it is. Allow yourself to be present to the lack of visual input. And now open your eyes. Even after 1 minute, the world seems brighter and fresher when you open your eyes. Imagine how you might feel to open your eyes at the age you are right now for the first time. Wouldn't you have more interesting things to do than argue the theology of how you could see? No wonder the man is not very patient. He gets put on trial, and then also his parents. But the author cleverly constructs the trial so that the account shows that it's really the Pharisees who are on trial here. And they don't come out very well. The translation that was used in the video clip had the Pharisees say to him, let me get it right, promise you will tell the truth. And the phrase that's used, that's a good translation to make sense of it. The phrase that's used is actually give glory to God, which is a euphemism in their culture for promise to tell the truth. But it's used ironically because the blind man does tell the truth, and in that he does give glory to God. And it's a truth the Pharisees didn't want to hear. The blind man says, isn't this an amazing thing? And what he's saying is amazing is not the miracle of his sight, but the astonishment that these people could not see it and not believe in this Jesus, given the miracle in front of them. The unbelief is the amazing thing here. I just need to have a note on the way Pharisees and Jews are used in this passage, mostly because it's one of the main things that theologians talking about this passage need to argue about. It slips through the 41 verses from talking about the Pharisees to talking about the Jews. Every character in this story is a Jew. But John is probably written at a time when the fledgling Christian community are starting to separate from the Jewish synagogues. Some are being cast out, and some are being encouraged by Christian leaders to leave and start something new. Some of that division has slipped backwards into this story. And there's a lot of theological debate about how much and how we should read that. But I think the thing it's important for us to know out of all that is that this is written for a community that has a difficult relationship with the religious authorities, the established religion, which is for them Judaism, and they're carving out a new identity as followers of Jesus. So the blind man's story becomes an emblem of what it means to have faith in the face of adversity. And the blind man is a heroic historical figure that they are encouraged then to emulate because he has faith and he sticks to it when he's in trouble. This is a passage full of questions, but there's a difference between the questions of interrogation and the question of invitation. The Pharisees interrogate and Jesus invites. And the question is left hanging to us all at the end, do you believe in the Son of Man? And that's an invitation, not an interrogation. It's not a question of fact, do you believe the Son of Man exists? But a question of loyalty. Will you be aligned with the Son of Man? So that gives us a bit of a context and brushstroke of what's in this passage. Now I'd like to pick up a few themes and questions that it raises for me in reading it. The first thing that comes to mind is to look for where is Jesus, which might seem obvious, but Jesus is not in the theological and religious argument. Jesus seeks out a blind man and heals him. Jesus seeks out a rejected man, expelled from the religious community, which in his time and culture is the only community, and invites that rejected man into a relationship of loyalty and trust. Jesus is being unsettling to the settled and hope to the hopeless. He says, I have come for judgment. Now, in the same book of John at 3:17, which is possibly my favourite verse in the whole Bible, the book says, I came not to condemn, but to save. Is that a contradiction that he's now saying he's come to judge? I think it's not, and I think it gives us an insight into what Jesus' judgment is about. It's not a judgment that we need to be afraid of, because Jesus promises to put himself in our place at the judgment, so that when judging is coming, who we are is wrapped up in who Jesus is, and we are judged as okay, as better than okay. We are judged as wonderfully worthy and welcome. We only need to worry if we are not prepared to need Jesus when there's judgment in the air, if we are blind and refuse enlightening. The next thing that jumps out to me, which is probably the reason I picked this passage over a couple of others, was the question the disciples ask at the start, which essentially is, why do bad things happen? Why was this man born blind? Did he sin or was it his parents? Now the theology that Jesus challenges, that suffering is caused by sin or even hereditary sin, is a theology I find extremely difficult. In fact, I frankly don't believe that sinners end up blind, for example. But the alternative is not necessarily much better, that God allows or even causes blindness so that God's goodness can be displayed when the blindness gets taken away. That's a tricky God to relate to as well. So what does this passage contribute to our understanding of suffering? Firstly, it is extremely significant that Jesus states that there is no relationship between sin and suffering. Suffering of this sort, at least. This is the complete opposite of what his culture believed and what his culture had believed for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's still embedded in our culture, even if we don't like it, that bad things happen to bad people. Why did this happen to me? I'm a good person. Is a reverse reflection of the same piece of theology, that sin causes suffering. Jesus is saying, no, it doesn't. And that's extremely important in itself. And then the story focuses away from the disaster of the man's blindness to the glaring goodness of God. The blindness is morally neutral. But Jesus says, God can use it for good. Now, I'm not saying that that solves the problem of suffering, but it is an aspect of this story. Another aspect is that Jesus' answer is specific to this man. He's asked about this man, and he answers about this man. Some suffering may well be the result of sin, in that some sin causes harm, as a consequence rather than as a punishment. For example, drug taking can melt your head. Hating someone rends a relationship. Telling lies traps you inside a false world. Building a nuclear power plant on a fault line perhaps is not the smartest idea in the world. But all suffering is not to allow God's work to be displayed. The early theologian Irenaeus says, "The word provided in public what the word had withheld in the womb." I'll read that again. The word, meaning the word capital, Jesus, the word provided in public what the word had withheld in the womb, i.e. sight. Now for me, this is a really helpful insight because it reminds me that all my faculties are miraculous gifts of God. We don't deserve them. Sight is not our birthright. Usually, God graciously grants us our basic faculties in the 9 months prior to our birth, and then goes on creating us throughout our life with all the wonderful expansions of our person. Balance, ball skills, and musical ability and maths, or if you're a bit lucky, maybe wisdom. For this man, sight was a later expansion and not part of the starter pack. Are we able to celebrate the astonishing gifts of our creation rather than focusing on what others have and we don't? That's not enough of an answer to suffering either, but it's also part of the complex weave. Another author writes that God is revealed not because healing a blind man is cool and therefore we go look at that cool thing that must be God, but because God is revealed to the blind man. That is, the man has his eyes opened and he sees the work of God, which is Jesus. I have to say, I think the Greek struggles a little bit with that interpretation. My Greek's not great, but I checked with my dad, whose Greek is a lot better than mine. The word could usually be interpreted as that God's, the phrase is, he was born blind so that God's work may be revealed, and then it's the tale, in him, by him, through him, are all the most likely translations. But my dad was also careful to say that it could be revealed to him. So, continuing with that line, if it's that God's works were revealed to him, then the man sees what he may have missed if he could already see everything. The conclusion of the whole passage is that those who are blind are those who have what they need to see Jesus. Blindness is the thing they need, the state to be sought after. Those who are not blind are the ones in trouble. Maybe they can just see too much to see the important thing. Blindness is not a disaster, but an opportunity. This story is an enacted parable where blindness, darkness, and light are the key elements. It is not trying to answer the suffering question, no matter how badly we want it to. So those things I've just said add to the conversation about suffering, but there is not an answer in this passage to why bad things happen. If this is a sign and not a miracle, then God's work is displayed by what it points to, not by the wonderful deed itself. And what it points to is Jesus' statement, which he states very strongly in the previous chapter, and he repeats here in chapter 9, "I am the light of the world." This whole story of the blind man is an illustration and acting out of that statement, a sign story saying, "I am the light of the world." Jesus as light is so very important to the author of John. Chapter 1 has it as part of the introduction, that glorious piece we read on Christmas Day. "The light shines in the darkness and the darkness could not overcome it." This is the introduction right at the start to say this light is what's coming, what this whole book is about. And it's repeated many, many times. The Greek in this passage is heavy with words coming from the root either phos, which is the word for light, or phaino, which is the word for give light or shine. So that statement about suffering, that this, he was born blind, that God's work may be revealed to him in him. Revealed is a word that comes from the same source as give light. So it might be translated something like to have the light shone into it or be lit up. Light shines on everyone and reveals who's saying yes and who's saying no, who is truly blind and who can see. But more importantly, light transforms the receiver. For me, it's like the difference between walking into a dark room with a torch and shining it onto a lampshade from across the room, or walking into a dark room and turning that lamp on. The light from inside the lampshade transforms not just the light but the whole room. Jesus, the light of the world, is perhaps like the bulb inside that brings the world to life. Not a beam from outside picking up flaws and faults. The blind man is open to let the physical light pour in, and in response he also welcomes in the light of the world, and that light pours out. John elsewhere says that some people prefer the darkness, and this blindness story has echoes of that too. In darkness, injustice can rule, as no one can see, so you can get away with whatever you like. So those whose power depends on corrupt means or brute force prefer darkness. In darkness, our false conceptions of reality can comfort and beguile us. So those who do not wish to change prefer darkness. What are our darknesses? What are your darknesses? Which do you hope to see lit? And which do you cling to? What does this light of the world mean for us? I am not sure I know. I have a sense that our electronic culture of light on tap blinds us to the significance of Jesus as light of the world. Light meant something different in first century Palestine to what it means to us now. And I don't think I get it. Perhaps if we get to question time, we might not. Others could have input into what you think that means. Throughout this whole passage, the blind man is honoured for recognising that he doesn't know, and the Pharisees are condemned for assuming that they do. So I hope my response to the light of the world is something like when the blind man is asked if he believes in the Son of Man. Well, if Jesus says so, then I'd like to believe. I just don't know what it means. The passage honours the ones who witness only what they really know. The blind man speaks only of what he absolutely knows, despite this causing him trouble. So does our theologising about it all matter? The questions of how and why. The parents speak only the barest bones of what they know, and they get written up as kind of having dodged a chance to witness. Now maybe that was all they knew, or maybe they did know, really, and they just didn't want to admit it because they were afraid. The ones who claim that they know, particularly those who claim they know about God, are shown as arrogant, setting themselves up as judges of God's revelation. The blind man demonstrates authenticity rather than arrogance. And the blind man is honoured for his steadfast integrity to his lived experience. He says, in essence, what I have experienced is true. You don't like it, and you don't like me. What I have experienced is still true. My experience of God's goodness is more important than anything you can threaten me with. What are the rationale we use for assessing what is true? This passage puts out a number of different alternatives, and they have conflicting outcomes. For some, the question of truth is, does this align with religious law as we know it? If not, it's falsehood or ungodly. Now, we at Mount Hawthorn might say, we don't really have religious law, so we're okay. But we have a lot of cultures and traditions that work as our religious paradigm. And if someone comes in here challenging it, I don't know that we react that different to a Pharisee. Another way that truth is assessed is this person a sinner? If they are, then their input is not valid. I have to say, if that's our assessment for truth, that's the end of all further input forever. There's two lots of responses within the Pharisees. And I think the video missed a line, because I think it missed the piece, the more positive Pharisees got a bit written out. One discerns truth from principles. The principle is Sabbath breakers are sinners, and the input of sinners is not valid. So this can't be good. The other discerns truth from the unique facts of each case. Jesus did a good work is the fact of this case, and they go from there, which is where early in the passage the comment is that the Pharisees were divided amongst themselves about how to interpret. The crowd discerns truth by, excuse me, Eva's climbing up my leg. Come on, honey. The crowd discerns truth by going to ask a religious expert so they don't have to make up their mind for themselves. Is he or isn't he the blind man, and what does it mean? Let's go ask the Pharisees. They don't necessarily take him to the Pharisees out of spite or to get him in trouble. They are the wise authorities of that culture. If you want to know something, they're the people to ask. They may have been quite genuinely wanting to figure out what had gone on. The parents discern truth, or at least what they'll talk about is truth, by what is expedient, what saves them.
Dad did all that.
Can you take that back to Daddy, please? And the blind man discerns truth by his own lived experience. When faith is cloudy, what is it that we do know? Can we hang on to just a few slivers? My faith for a long time boiled down really to God is good, God knows what God's doing, I need God. And at heart, that's still the crux of it, although two out of those 3 points I struggle with at times. And so I perhaps amended it today, could change tomorrow too. The mystery of Christ creates life. For me, I need God. It can be a worthwhile exercise, especially in our church that doesn't have creeds we adhere to, for you to find some core kernels that you have experienced as true, that you can hang on to when there's a fog. How do we respond then when something challenges our worldview, our moral universe, our way of assessing truth, our system of being? Considering this question got me thinking about a friend of mine who came out as bisexual about 6 months ago, and she has wonderful, devout, faithful parents, Christian parents. And her father in particular, who's in his 70s, cannot find a way to fit inside his moral universe a daughter who's not straight. Changing his view on this one issue, the sin or otherwise of alternate sexualities, would mean rearranging the whole way he constructs truth. And after a lifetime of constructing truth one way, he has thus far not been able to make the seismic shift required to include this in his aspect of loving his daughter. It's easier to see her as a sinner and to try and love her as a sinner and maybe, well, probably try and change her than to, in his mid-70s, apply a different rationale to how he determines what is true. He is a good man who loves his daughter. It's easy for me to think he should just get over it and change. But it's not about this one issue. It's about a whole system of belief and a life of trusting that system to work, and it always has until now. And it's easy for us to see the Pharisees as caricature bad people who should have just got over it and got on with Jesus' program. And the gospel writers are quite happy to encourage that impression. But we are asking a lot of those Pharisees, probably more than we ask of ourselves. Think for a moment of one or two truths that are important to you about how the world operates, or what God is like, or how we are to live. And now imagine that someone in your suburb reports an experience that casts doubt on those things, those truths that are important to you. How likely are you to change? What if it's someone in your street? Or maybe in our church? Or in your family? What if it's you who has this experience? We change slowly and reluctantly, and usually only under the pressure of evidence that we cannot dispute or ignore, like our own suffering or our inability to control the universe. Actually, that is still an issue and I'm not changing. Working on it. The Pharisees are so devoutly committed to their system for living in the world that they could not see the new thing that God was doing. Are we open to new things? And always the vexed question remains, is this new thing of God or not? And there is no easy answer. Some time-honoured ways and values are good and right. And sometimes two pieces of our own experience seem to tell us two opposing truths. In all humility, we must seek God's wisdom case by case by case. The blind man, when asked if he believed in the Son of Man, did not say yes, because that would have been committing himself to something beyond what he knew. Rather, he deferred to Jesus. He knew Jesus as the man who healed him. He knew he was a prophet. He knew he was of God. That much he had stated publicly. So when Jesus said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" he put it back to Jesus. "You tell me who he is and I will believe in him." This Son of God caper, Son of Man, well, this might be God's new thing. But the way to check was to ask Jesus. Do we check? And if we do check, do we listen for an answer? Finally, this passage brings up the whole issue of the guilt of thinking we're not guilty. And the singing group I facilitated at my previous church, one evening, one of the more senior men stunned me by saying casually, "Oh, I don't sin anymore." And I responded tactfully with something like, "What?" And he said reassuringly, "Oh, no, I used to sin, but it's probably been 10 years, I think." And it's one of the few times in my life that I have been utterly and completely speechless. But in truth, my response inside was probably something like, "You rotten, lying sinner. I'm much better than you. I would never lie and sin like that." And that conversation comes to mind when I read Jesus' provocative statements at the end of this passage. The problem is not what we do or don't think, but our willingness to be aware of how it might look from God's perspective. The story is about original blindness, not original sin. Sin is not handed down from our parents, and that's stated quite clearly at the start. Jesus says it's not about sin coming down. Blindness is our inability to see the shalom of God, and I'm using Sandra Snyder again. Blindness is the place where God can reach us, the occasion of God's saving action in our lives. What does that mean? Our blindness is to think we are the centre or somewhere near it. And our view of the world is the ultimate one. It's only when we recognise that we don't have the map that God can orient us in the right direction and start to give us glimpses of how the whole picture might fit. God meets us in our blindness, in that God comes to us when we admit we are in need. Why do some respond and others not? We cannot see God if we seek our own glory and put ourselves rather than God as the source and norm of all reality, and seek to control God, through our religion. We cannot see God without the illumination of the light of the world and the transformation that Jesus light works in us. So how do we respond to Jesus? The blind man responds with an unfolding awareness, witnessing at every stage to exactly what he does know and nothing more, just his experience. Jesus is the man who healed me, a prophet from God, and finally the Son of Man. The crowd responds with scepticism and then takes the question to the religious leaders for an answer. The parents respond by laying low. Fear wins. Their own son is healed, and rather than find out how and celebrate the miracle, they say as little as possible and seem to not want to know. The Pharisees respond with fear, anger, and rejection. Jesus does not fit their world, and they choose their world instead of Jesus. Do we respond at all? Do we celebrate? Or are we stuck in arguing, defending, proving, and theorising? Can we just be grateful and celebrate the goodness of God? Is it all so old hat that we're more likely to cozy up to Jesus for a chat than fall down and kiss Jesus' feet, which is the word used for the blind man's response at the end? Not that a cozy chat in itself is a bad thing, but we can forget who it is who has invited us to be cozy with him. Not just any old nice guy, but a truly astonishing, world-changing human who also happens to be God, who entered human history to die and rise in an unfathomable mystery that changes everything between us and God, who takes our blindness and turns it around so that we are utterly and eternally home.